Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. The first article is titled, Every Day Like It Was His Last, Loved Ones Mourn 21-Year-Old Killed in Glendale Shooting, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. A chorus of sharp gasps and breathless sobs was the soundtrack to a chilly May evening in downtown Glendale as the community rallied around the family of a man who has lost in a restaurant gunfight. I'm sorry, Milo, his friends kept repeating, each time more desperate and heartbroken than the last. He can't be gone, others said. The crew of 10 or so close-knit friends huddled around Milo's memorial at the site he was killed. Milo Suniga, 21, was one of three killed May 4th during a Cinco de Mayo celebration. Behind the brightly lit Welcome to Glendale sign, hundreds of people gathered in the parking lot of El Camarón Gigante for a candlelight vigil, the perimeter of the lot flanked by a motorcycle club. The tears of family, friends, and community members stained to the ground where three people were killed and five others injured. Milo was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, caught in the crossfire, his cousin, Veronica Tarango, said. He wasn't a violent or confrontational person, she said. He lived every day like it was his last, Tarango told the Arizona Republic at the vigil May 6th. He enjoyed every second of his life. Milo was a proud Mexican and Native American man who loved his community and learning about his culture, Tarango said. He was sarcastic, funny, loving, and caring. A true gentleman, Tarango said. He was raised that way, according to his dad, Angel Suniga. Milo's passion was in building and restoring cars, something that brought him out to the event which featured lowriders, Angel said. The father and son worked on cars together, and Milo hoped to continue working with cars as a career after college. Police said shots were fired by multiple people in the parking lot outside of El Camarón Gigante, a mariscos and steak restaurant, as a Cinco de Mayo celebration happened inside the venue. Brothers Damian Anthony Sproul, 17, and Christopher Joaquin Sproul, 21, were killed, along with Milo. Police have not said what role the three played in the fight, if any. Milo's family maintained that he was a bystander. Milo and his family were Glendale natives and occasionally visited El Camarón Gigante. Durango said the incident came as a shock. It's not something you would think ever would happen, you know, she said. The celebration organizers routinely host neighborhood gatherings in the area. On a Sunday afternoon, which also goes by OASA, describes itself as a lifestyle brand staying true to the culture and all things Chicano. The group said its events were made to create a safe space for friends and families. That safety was taken from us last night, and we will never take that lightly. On a Sunday afternoon, leaders said in a statement, Our thoughts remain with those grieving, and our commitment to our community has never been stronger. While police have called the shooting an isolated incident stemming from bad blood between those involved, it has brought a national attention to an area of Glendale that has for years struggled to regain its footing as a destination for shopping and dining. Some local business owners appeared to shrug off the incident, with the owner of the Black Sheep Coffee Shop, Lynn Frederick, saying, It's Glendale. The restaurant where the May 4th shooting occurred, El Camarón Gigante, has had numerous police calls in the years since it opened, including a stabbing March 30th. We're not immune to violence, said former Glendale councilmember Jaime Aldama. But this isn't indicative of the West Valley. Glendale police are still searching for the suspects in the shooting. Milo's father pushed for justice, believing it will come only after police make an arrest. He was a very good kid, Angel said. That's who he was, and I just want justice for him. The next article is titled, A Three-Year-Old Girl Dies After Being Shot by Her Father During Police Standoff, by Perry Vandell, Arizona Republic. A surprised father faces multiple felony charges, including homicide, after police said he shot his three-year-old daughter during a standoff with police. She died at a hospital days later. Sergeant Rick Hernandez, a department spokesperson, said officers responded to a home near 184th Drive and Bell Road on May 1st after receiving calls about a man acting erratically just after 6:30 p.m. Hernandez said the man, 48-year-old Darius Modrisky, also called 911 and threatened to harm his family. Hernandez had crisis negotiators with the department's SWAT team try to work toward a peaceful solution as other officers set up a perimeter around the residence. Hernandez said officers immediately forced their way into the home after they heard a gunshot, where they found a 3-year-old girl who had been shot. The girl, identified as Madruski's daughter, was rushed to a hospital but ultimately died from her injuries May 5th. Hernandez said officers arrested Madruski without further incident and booked him into jail on multiple aggravated assault charges. He added that the department was working with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office to add a homicide charge as well. Darius Madruski is being held on a $1 million bond. Information regarding Madruski's next court date was not immediately available as of May 5th. The next article is titled, Families of Those Killed in Glendale Shooting Seek Donations to Fund Funerals, by Perry Vandell, Arizona Republic. Families of the victims who were killed on May 4th in a mass shooting that occurred at a crowded dance party launched GoFundMe campaigns to help fund funeral arrangements. A fight escalated into a deadly shootout in the parking lot of El Camarón Gigante at North 57th Drive and West Lamar Road near historic downtown Glendale. 3 people, including a pair of brothers, were killed and 5 others injured. A candlelight vigil was planned for 6:30 p.m. on May 6th at Murphy Park. The park is in downtown Glendale at the intersection of West Glendale Avenue and North 58th Avenue, about 2 blocks from the shooting site. Regina LaRoche, who said she was the mother of brothers Damian Anthony Sproul, 17, and Christopher Joaquin Sproul, 21, said her heart was broken. Damian leaves behind a 6-month-old baby, and Chris is the father of a 4-year-old autistic son and a 2-year-old daughter, LaRoche wrote on GoFundMe. We are struggling to cope with this unimaginable tragedy. We're asking for support to help lay them to rest and to care for the young children they left behind. Any donation, prayer, or share means the world. The GoFundMe has raised nearly $2,500 as of 1 p.m. on May 6th, with a goal of $15,000. The page featured photos of the brothers together with their children. LaRoche spoke with the Arizona Republic May 6th and said her family was devastated by the loss of Damian and Christopher. LaRoche, their mother, said they attended the lowrider event to make friends as they had recently gotten into lowriders as a hobby. Jamie Suniga, a family member of Milo Christopher Suniga, 21, also posted a GoFundMe requesting donations to help with funeral expenses. We all know what an amazing kid Milo was, and he would do anything for anyone with no questions asked, the post said. All support would be greatly appreciated and accepted with love. The post said a funeral service had not been scheduled, but that information would be shared once it's established. The GoFundMe had raised over $4,500, with a goal of $7,500. Suniga did not immediately respond to the Republic as of May 6th. Glendale police investigators were working to identify suspects and had not made any arrests by the early afternoon on May 6th. Detectives are actively working this case and are continuing to ask the public to provide any and all information that could lead them to make an arrest, Glendale police spokesperson Jose Santiago said. Santiago said the incident was isolated and stemmed from the people involved in the fight having a history of bad blood between them. He said it was unknown how the people feuding knew each other. Officers detained multiple people after arriving on the scene Sunday night, Santiago said. There were multiple shooters, he said, and some of the injured were potentially just bystanders. It was unclear whether those wounded were in the restaurant or in the parking lot when the shooting began, he said. Santiago said there were 200 to 300 people at the event. He encouraged anyone with information about the incident to anonymously upload any videos or photos they have of the incident to a web portal. Santiago said people can share tips by calling the department at 623-930-3000. The next article is titled, Man Breaks Knife While Killing Girlfriend's Father in Their North Phoenix Home, Police Say, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. A family dispute led to one man violently stabbing and killing another in their shared residence in North Phoenix, according to court records. Arresting documents obtained by the Republic revealed that Daniel Coles, 38, stabbed his girlfriend's father, 73-year-old Jack Olson, multiple times May 2nd. Coles claimed he did so because of how Olson treated his daughter. According to the documents, Coles planned to break Olson's neck and attempted to do so when he came home from work but was unsuccessful. He then grabbed a knife and stabbed Olson until the knife broke. Coles got a second knife from the kitchen and stabbed Olson several more times. Coles went to the bathroom and showered, according to court documents. The girlfriend, who was not identified, witnessed the attack, court documents said. She called police after the stabbing when Coles was in the shower. Coles fled the scene on foot, but left behind a bloodied watch and knife, court documents stated. The broken knife was found in the kitchen, according to court records. Officers found him at a nearby park, hiding in the women's restroom after the girlfriend told him that he killed her father, documents confirmed. The girlfriend, her father, and Coles lived together near 35th Street and Campo Bello Rut Drive. Coles was charged with one count, a first-degree premeditated murder, a Class 1 felony. He was being held on $500,000 bond. His next court appearance was scheduled for May 8th. The next article is titled, Capable Swimmer Drowned at Bartlett Lake in Carefree. His body has now been recovered, by Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. The body of the 21-year-old man who drowned after falling underwater during a walk on the Bartlett Lake Flat shoreline area in Carefree has been recovered, according to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Juan Ojeda Valdez, who was on the afternoon of May 3rd, was walking across the SB Cove with friends when he lost his footing near the walk's length, drowned, and was recovered the following day, said the sheriff's office. Though witnesses described him as a capable swimmer, the combination of cold water temperatures and him falling about 15 feet into the water led to his death, the sheriff's office said. A second person, roughly 30 feet away, also struggled in the water but made it to safety, the sheriff's office said. Not wearing a life jacket, Ojeda Valdez was underwater for 15 minutes with two people trying to rescue him, according to the sheriff's office. A ground and water search operation was set up and included divers jumping into the waters before the body was found May 4th, the agency added. No foul play was suspected, the sheriff's office said. The next article is titled, Man Shot Outside Popular Tempe Bar. Shooter fled in white sedan, police say. By Alexandra Hartle, Arizona Republic. A man in his 30s was shot multiple times in a parking lot near Casey Moore's Oyster House in Tempe just before 3 p.m. on May 3rd, police said. He was shot in the stomach, Tempe police said. He was in critical but stable condition and was taken to a hospital. A call about the shooting came in to police at 2:52 p.m. The shooting was part of an altercation between two men and one woman, police said. The shooter left the scene in a white sedan, police said. Police said they knew who was involved in the incident and were searching for them. There was no immediate threat to the public, police said. Tempe police asked anyone who witnessed or had information about the shooting to call 480-350-8311. Casey Moore's is two blocks west of Mill Avenue and one block south of University Drive at the intersection of Ash Avenue and 9th Street. At about 5 p.m., the restaurant posted on Facebook that it would be closed for the night and reopen at 11 a.m. on May 4th. At about 6 p.m., the area was mostly empty except for a few police vehicles. Much of 9th Street near the bar remained closed. Casey Moore's sat completely empty, with Mister's still running and a temporarily closed sign posted on the gate. Police at the scene had no further updates. Customers approached the gates at the restaurant before turning away to find a new place to spend their Saturday evening. A bartender at the establishment declined to comment on the shooting around 11 a.m. on May 4th and directed any additional inquiries to law enforcement. The next article is titled, Phoenix Man Facing Murder Charges After Police Say He Fatally Stabbed His Roommate, by Taylor Seeley, Arizona Republic. Phoenix police arrested a man accused of stabbing his roommate to death and booked him into a jail on murder charges. Daniel Coles, 38, was suspected of fatally stabbing 73-year-old Jack Olson. Officers responded to a call at 11:45 a.m. on May 2nd at a home near 35th Street and Campobello Drive. When they got to the scene, they found Olson lying on the floor suffering multiple stab wounds, according to police. The Phoenix Fire Department also responded to the home, but Olson died at the scene, police said. Officers searched the area after a witness told them Coles was responsible and that he had left by foot, police said. Coles was found at a nearby park and taken into custody, police said. Homicide investigators took over the investigation to interview witnesses and process the scene. Detectives later interviewed Coles, where he provided statements linking him to the stabbing, Sergeant Phil Krinsky with Phoenix Police said. He was later booked on murder charges. The investigation remained open, and no other suspects were believed to be outstanding, police said. The next article is titled, Orchid Fever Blooms at the Desert Botanical Garden Now Through May 11th. Desert Botanical Garden. Desert Botanical Garden invites visitors to experience its first ever indoor orchid show, Orchid Fever, now open through May 11th. Set within the garden's new The RAF Exhibit Gallery, this floral display brings a burst of tropical color to the Sonoran Desert, featuring more than 3,000 orchids across 18 species. Whether you're a devoted orchid lover or simply seeking a sensory escape, Orchid Fever promises a feast of form, fragrance, and living art. Stepping into exhibit, guests leave the arid garden trails behind and enter a lush oasis of cascading blooms. Orchids in fuchsia, sunset orange, lemon yellow, and royal purple arch overhead and spill across raised platforms, artfully paired with native cactus and succulents. Orchid Fever also highlights the garden's commitment to research and conservation. Highlighted specimens include several of Arizona's own endangered orchid varieties, rescued from riparian habitats and now cultivated under garden scientists' care. Did you know orchids grow in Arizona? Garden researchers Andrew Solyuan and Steve Blackwell talk about the garden's research and conservation work around the rare Canelo Hills Ladies' Tresses orchid, Sapanthus delectescens, native to southern Arizona. Orchid Fever runs daily from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Members enjoy early entry at 7 a.m. on Wednesdays and Sundays. Admission is included with general garden entry, no extra fee required, though advance ticket reservations are strongly recommended. Don't forget to stop by the garden shop, where select orchid plants, potting supplies, and Orchid Fever souvenirs are available while supplies last. While Orchid Fever dazzles indoors, the rest of Desert Botanical Gardens await outside. After soaking in the gallery's kaleidoscope of orchids, visitors can wander desert trails alive with wildflowers or enjoy a visit the butterfly exhibit. Flutter with 1,000-plus butterflies this spring at the Cone Family Butterfly Pavilion. Snap the perfect selfie with these winged wonders, discover fascinating facts about pollinators, and immerse yourself in the beauty of the garden. No visit to the garden is complete with a stop at Gertrude's Restaurant. Savor the flavors of the Southwest at Gertrude's, nestled in the heart of the Desert Botanical Garden. With fresh, locally sourced ingredients and vibrant seasonal dishes, Gertrude's offers a garden-to-table experience like no other. Come for the stunning desert views, stay for the unforgettable cuisine. The garden is open daily. Tickets are available at dbg.org. The next article is titled, Jurors Watch Graphic Video of Cleophas Cooksey Jr.'s Arrest in Phoenix After Parents Found Dead, by Miguel Torres, Arizona Republic. Jurors heard from Phoenix police officers and neighbors on May 6th as prosecutors played disturbing footage of Cleophas Cooksey Jr.'s arrest and recounted the chaos found inside his mother's blood-soaked apartment in December 2017. Cooksey faces 8 first-degree murder charges stemming from a violent spree of killings that spread through the valley in November and December 2017. The second day of testimony focused on the night Cooksey's 56-year-old mother, Renee Cooksey, and her husband, Edward Nunn, were killed. Police responded to reports of gunshots at the couple's apartment at East Highland Avenue and North 14th Street, where they were met by a gruesome scene and a man behaving erratically. Officer Brian Othament told jurors he immediately noticed blood pooled outside the front door, streaked up the screen, and smeared across the concrete. It was clear someone inside had been badly hurt, he said. As Othament knocked, Cooksey emerged from behind the locked metal screen door. He kept his right hand hidden behind his back and claimed everything was fine. Then, Othament said, the situation escalated. Cooksey began shouting that he was the strongest man alive, threatened to slit the officers' throats, and declared that he controlled the gun. Officers eventually subdued and arrested him, but not before he launched into a bizarre rant captured on police body camera. In the video playing for the jury, Cooksey is heard yelling, "It's me, Trump! It's me, Trump!" and claiming he worked for the FBI. "Donald Trump, you know what's up?" he screamed. "You know why I took care of that? Donald Trump." Inside the apartment, the scene was even more horrific. Officers testified they found the couple's bodies just past the entryway. Blood covered the walls, sprayed the kitchen ceiling, and pooled on the floor. Renee Cooksey had been shot in the head. The bullet was later recovered from her neck. Edward Nunn had been shot between the eyes at close range. Photos of the crime scene were shown in court, including images of a blood-soaked tissue at the doorstep. Othman testified that the images matched what he saw that night, a scene of unimaginable violence. The jury also heard from Natalie Blair, a neighbor who lived directly across from the Cooksey apartment. A schoolteacher, Blair said, she was watching TV with her husband, Adam, when she heard three or four loud pops. Fearing for her safety, she walked to her kitchen window and peeked through the blinds, avoiding the front window closest to the door. What she saw next, she testified, has stayed with her. Through the open screen door of the Cooksey apartment, she saw Renee Cooksey lying on her right hip, propped up on one arm and clutching her chest with the other. Blair estimated Renee Cooksey was just 1 to 2 feet inside. She was rocking slightly, like she was trying to breathe, Blair said. Blair watched for about 5 seconds before returning to tell her husband what she saw, she said. Moments later, she heard yelling and what sounded like more gunshots. On direct examination, Blair said she believed she saw blood on Renee Cooksey's chest. But under cross-examination, defense attorney Robert Reinhardt pressed her on why she hadn't shared that detail in any previous interviews or with 911. "You never told police you saw blood, did you?" Reinhardt said. "No one asked me," Blair replied, admitting it was the first time she had ever mentioned it. Reinhardt also mentioned Blair's ability to identify voices she heard that night. Blair said she thought it was Edward Nunn shouting, "Get out," and something about Satan, but conceded she had never spoken to him beyond brief greetings and knew him only by sight. She had more contact with Cleophas Cooksey, she said. Brief conversations, including one where he encouraged her to look up his music on YouTube. "It was not easy to have a conversation with him," Blair testified, describing Cleophas Cooksey as immature and difficult to engage. After the shooting, Blair said, she saw Cleophas Cooksey open the door and begin speaking nonsensically, invoking Trump and the FBI. Answering Reinhardt's questions, she admitted that she thought Cooksey's demeanor had changed, like a switch had flipped. Cooksey has pleaded not guilty. The trial was scheduled to continue May 7th and last for 4 months. The next article is titled, "Phoenix Man Sentenced for Threatening Federal Judge Susan Brnovich Over Geico Case," by Miguel Torres, Arizona Republic. He stood before the court and spoke with strain in his voice. "I have a broken heart to see what the system did to me," Casey Purrington said, railing against a country to which he no longer wished to belong. What followed was the culmination of nearly a decade of frustration, litigation, and collapse, legal, emotional, and personal. Purrington, 40, was sentenced on May 6th to time served and 3 years of supervised release for threatening a federal judge he once believed would deliver him justice. Instead, he said, she broke him. He threatened her life. At his sentencing, Purrington of Phoenix said U.S. District Judge Susan Brnovich misled him during his civil case against his car insurer. He said if a defendant had misled a judge in the same way, they would have faced consequences, yet Brnovich faced none. According to prosecutors, Purrington sent 89 emails and made roughly 300 calls to Brnovich's chambers. In one email, he wrote, "Gotcha!" expletive. "Hope you have fun on this journey I'm about to take you on, you dumb expletive." Judge John Z. Boyle, who presided over the sentencing, said Purrington's conduct left a broader impact. "They were scared. I'm not sure if you can appreciate that, Mr. Purrington, that it wasn't just the victim judge, it was also her staff," Boyle said. "But the fact of the matter is that when a broken heart reveals itself in the way that we have seen, it is frightening." Boyle said there has been a national rise in threats against federal judges. The U.S. Marshals report that in the past 10 years, threats have increased 300%, he said, citing cases where threats had led to deadly attacks on judges' families. Purrington said he knew that court staff were not to blame. I wanted to be heard, and I was willing to scream out loud to do it. I mean, it wasn't just the courts. I mean, I went to the news media. I went to everybody I could possibly go to, and it only fell on deaf ears, he said. The civil lawsuit defeat consumed him. He lost his partner after 10 years and said he was left to pay his own medical bills and legal fees. He told the court he had a fighter mentality and that he only wanted those with contracts and a duty to care for him to fulfill that responsibility. They didn't, he said. A 2016 car crash on Camelback Road triggered the chain of events that ultimately led to Purrington's sentencing. He was injured when another driver turned into his lane. After collecting the maximum payout from the other driver's insurer, Purrington sought $100,000 from GEICO under his underinsured motorist policy. GEICO offered $5,500, arguing his injuries were minimal. In 2019, Purrington sued GEICO in Maricopa County Superior Court for breach of contract and bad faith. The case was later moved to a federal court. In June of that year, GEICO successfully requested the court to split Purrington's two claims. Brnovich paused all proceedings on the bad faith portion until the breach of contract issue was resolved. To Purrington, that ruling was a turning point. He said it blocked him from obtaining internal GEICO documents that he believed would prove the company acted in bad faith. That opened up the door for GEICO to file a motion for summary judgment, Purrington said at sentencing. I was in a federal court. It was a civil case, and he had the right to a jury trial, he said. In December 2020, Brnovich dismissed the entire case, ruling GEICO's $5,500 offer was fairly debatable, a legal standard used in some insurance cases. The court never revisited the bad faith claim. Boyle accepted a plea agreement between Purrington and the U.S. Attorney's Office, sentencing him to time already served, about 1 year in custody, followed by 3 years of supervised release. Purrington pleaded guilty to a felony count of threatening a federal official. As part of the sentencing, two counts, which involved threats allegedly made to a member of the Phoenix mayor's staff and the Arizona Commission on Judicial Conduct, were dismissed. Purrington told the court he planned to leave the U.S. after completing probation and renounce his citizenship. Please don't waste any more of my time or my energy, he said. Let me fix my broken heart. Let me move on. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we will continue with the news. The next article is titled, Heading to Flagstaff from Phoenix? Be prepared for a traffic change along Interstate 17, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. As you drive along Interstate 17, you may have noticed stalled traffic and sometimes hours-long backups near Black Canyon City before alleviating at Sunset Point. The Arizona Department of Transportation is working to fix this traffic congestion by the end of the year. But in the meantime, driving northbound on I-17 will look a bit different. Starting May 5th, northbound traffic shifted into two newly constructed flex lanes that run adjacent to the two existing southbound lanes. The department said the detour was necessary for several weeks as work continued on the main northbound lanes between Colorado Coldwater Road and Sunset Point. Southbound traffic will continue to use the general purpose lanes, which are business as usual. Here's what you need to know. Where is the lane change? Northbound drivers will transition from the regular lanes at Coldwater Road in Black Canyon City and use newly constructed crossover lanes to enter two flex lanes. Drivers will continue on the flex lanes for 8 miles and rejoin the main general purpose lanes through another set of crossover lanes at Sunset Point. How long are the flex lanes? Drivers will travel on the flex lanes for about 8 miles between Coldwater Road and Sunset Point. What exits are closed? The I-7 construction also includes bridge work at Bumblebee Road. While the detour is in place, drivers will not be able to access the northbound Bumblebee Road exit. Bumblebee Road, under northbound I-17, will be closed to traffic. What is the construction project? The I-17 improvement project covers 23 miles of construction between Anthem Way and Sunset Point. Construction began in 2022 and is expected to be completed by the end of 2025. ADOT said the project aims to enhance safety, improve traffic flow, and support local economies. Project highlights include widening 15 miles of roadway between Anthem Way and Coldwater Road in Black Canyon City, replacing two bridges and widening 10 others, constructing about 8 miles of flex lanes between Coldwater Road and Sunset Point. What are flex lanes? According to ADOT, flex lanes operate as an additional two-lane roadway that carries one direction of traffic at a time. The lanes will alternate between northbound and southbound depending on the greatest traffic need. ADOT noted that the I-17 flex lanes will not operate as such during the traffic shift. The lanes will only support northbound traffic. The next article is titled, UA Faculty Overwhelmingly Call for University Leaders to Defend Against Trump's DEI Demands, by Helen Rummel, Arizona Republic. Hundreds of University of Arizona faculty members are calling on school leadership to take a stand against the Trump administration following escalating demands from the country's highest office. About 91% of the nearly 1,000 faculty members who responded to a referendum from early May are asking the UA administration to defend the university from ideological and governmental attacks. The school employs roughly 4,000 faculty. The vote comes as the Trump administration is putting pressure on schools to eradicate all programs tied to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and cuts millions of dollars in federal research funding. The referendum made several other asks, including directing leadership to fight unlawful demands that threatened academic freedom, shared governance, or the safety of students and faculty. It also supported efforts like those seen at other schools, like mutual defense compacts and the signing of open letters. Several universities across the country have come up with new strategies to defend themselves against politicians. Harvard University sued the Trump administration last month after it was stripped of billions in funding for declining to obey a slew of demands, ranging from hiring overhauls to DEI demands, or DEI bans. Faculty at other colleges have voted in favor of mutual defense compacts, including many within the Big Ten Academic Alliance. The compact requests that university leaders put money toward a shared legal defense fund for schools to use if they face political or legal threats. Those who approved the referendum also want UA President Suresh Garamella to sign a recent open letter from the American Association of Colleges and Universities, which opposed what leaders called unprecedented government overreach and political interference now endangering American higher education. None of the leaders of Arizona's public universities has signed the letter, which received support from more than 100 colleges, including the University of Michigan and Northwestern University. In response, UA officials said they're engaged with federal and state leaders and will continue to collaborate with national education organizations. Colleges and universities play a vital role in our nation, and we will continue to do so even in the face of significant change and uncertainty, UA spokesperson Mitch Zack said in a statement. We value the engagement of University of Arizona faculty, staff, students, and community members as we chart a path forward. We will continue to focus on student success, research excellence, and meaningful engagement with our state. This includes promoting an environment where all members of our community find belonging and purpose. Zack also pointed to the millions of dollars in funds UA receives from federal and state governments, which adds up to more than $470 million in federal research grants, $380 million in state funding, and more than $70 million in Pell grants. University leaders have consistently maintained that they are complying with orders from federal and state officials. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Education shared a four-page letter demanding schools remove any race-based or programming, with few specifics included. Schools were given a two-week deadline. UA officials quickly removed its website of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion and said it was assessing its diversity, equity, and inclusion. Garamella also sent a letter to Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson in April, assuring the Gilbert Republican that the school was discontinuing any preferential treatment. We will keep you informed as this work moves toward completion. Please let me know if you have any questions that we can help answer for you. The letter, shared on X, reads, Peterson does not have an official oversight position over the university. Caramella's letter was in response to a message sent from Peterson to all three of the state's major public universities, directing them to abide by an executive order targeting DEI initiatives in schools. The decision was met with outcry from many students and faculty. Demonstrations were taking place on the Tucson campus from May 5th to 7th across several cultural resource centers, including the Asian Pacific American Student Affairs Center, the Guerrero Center, LGBTQ+2S Center, and the Women and Gender Resource Center. "Let's show UA that when DEI is under attack, we stand up and fight back," a social media post publicizing the event read. Julio Camarota, a UA education professor, shared his support for the cultural centers at May 5th Faculty Senate meeting. He said he and many of his colleagues are concerned about the changes the university may make following its audit. "It jeopardizes over four decades of progress in civil rights advocacy, student empowerment, and community engagement," Camarota said. "These centers are not just offices, they are sanctuaries." The next article is titled, "Mesa Public School for Deaf Students Will Turn Private, Rely on Vouchers," by Madeline Parrish, Arizona Republic. After facing the threat of closure, a Mesa charter school for deaf and hard of hearing students will turn into a private school funded by vouchers. Sequoia Deaf School, which opened in 1998, was facing the possibility of closure as its operator, the EdKey Charter School Network, continued to struggle financially. EdKey, which is based in Mesa, abruptly closed two Northern Arizona schools over spring break this school year. Its governing body recently voted to close another school, Chorus Academy in Phoenix, at the end of 2024-25 school year. In 2019, the Arizona Republic reported that EdKey had accumulated millions in debt to fund its expansion. Sequoia Deaf School is small, and parents were told by EdKey in March that enrollment would need to be significantly increased for the school to remain viable. The threat of shutdown worried parents, some of whom saw the school as a unique and critical resource for their children. Susan Hernandez, whose second-grade son attends Sequoia Deaf School, said she valued the school's bilingual focus, where students learn English and American Sign Language. That model, she said, has helped her son, who is deaf and recently began regularly wearing cochlear implants, begin to develop open spoken English alongside ASL. Audra Paletta, whose daughter has attended Sequoia Deaf School since 2020, said she fell very much in love with the fact that the school shares a campus with another EdKey charter school for hearing students. That has allowed her daughter, who wears cochlear implants, to interact with hearing peers. Paletta's daughter's speech and sign language skills have taken off, she said. "She's so much more confident. She's happy being surrounded by peers that understand her, and she's also able to communicate with her family members that are not deaf. And for Philip Acosta's son, Sequoia Deaf School has been the best thing." "Everybody can relate to one another," Acosta said. "They're not singled out like they would be anywhere else." Paletta was devastated and angry when she heard of the school's possible closure. Acosta worried about the communication challenges and possible bullying his son might face if he were to attend a regular public school. Acosta, Hernandez, and Paletta said they were not aware of any other school in the East Valley focused on deaf students. Each of them had enrolled their children at one time in Phoenix Day School for the Deaf in northern Phoenix, but the commute from the East Valley is long. "There are so few options for deaf and hard-of-hearing students. Please do not take away one of the only lifelines they have," Hernandez wrote in a letter to EdKey earlier this year. Sequoia Deaf School told parents in February that EdKey was planning to close the school. In late March, parents received a message from EdKey asking them to help grow the school's enrollment. Then in April, Sequoia Deaf School announced it would close at the end of the school year as an EdKey-operated public charter school, but reopen in the 2025-26 school year as a private school funded through Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship Account program, which allows all students not enrolled in public school to receive state funds for private school tuition or homeschooling materials. The school will be leased and operated by Victory Schools, which will rename it Victory Deaf Academy, and charge $35,000 in annual tuition. That amount was determined based on the specialized resources, staff-to-student ratios, and language-accessible supports necessary to serve deaf and hard-of-hearing students effectively, according to a statement from Nick Schuerman, the CEO and founder of Victory Schools. According to Doug Nick, a spokesperson for the Arizona Department of Education, Sequoia Deaf School received about $36,010 per student in state funding in fiscal year 2024, with a total revenue of $1,473,552. Schuerman said Victory Schools was confident that most families will be able to cover the full $35,000 tuition with their vouchers, but that families would not be charged the difference if they received less than that from the state. While the median annual Empowerment Scholarship Account award is about $7,400 per student, students with disabilities generally receive more funding. According to the program's most recent report, more than 6,800 students received a voucher award of $30,000 or more. Hernandez said she planned to keep her son in school, and she was excited to start this new path. Paletta applied for an Empowerment Scholarship account and was working on enrolling her daughter in Victory Deaf Academy, but said she had very mixed emotions because she became attached to the school as it has been. She was trying to be optimistic, however, and said she hoped the new school would be advantageous for her daughter. Acosta said he was feeling really good about Victory Schools. "I'm just grateful they're stepping up and making it possible for the students to remain together," he said. Staff from Sequoia Deaf School were asked to reapply. Victory Schools also plan to make several enhancements, which could include facility upgrades, expanded language-accessible programming, improved social-emotional supports, and enriched academy academic opportunities, Schuerman said. Victory Schools, based in Phoenix, also operates 8 private autism schools, a private micro high school in Phoenix, and a K-8 charter school in Maryvale. "Moving forward, our vision for Victory Deaf Academy is to build a premier program grounded in high expectations, deaf culture, language accessibility, and a deep sense of connection, community, and confidence," Schuerman said. We move on now to USA Today. And the first article there is titled, "No Pope Named as Black Smoke Rises on Historic Conclave's First Day, Live Updates," by John Bacon and Jorge L. Ortiz, USA Today. Black smoke plumed over the Vatican into the night sky in Rome on Wednesday, signaling the historic papal conclave did not reach consensus on a successor to Pope Francis, and the cardinals will reconvene at the Sistine Chapel on Thursday. Tens of thousands had packed St. Peter's Square as darkness fell, all eyes watching for smoke from the iconic chapel's chimney. Earlier Wednesday, a solemn procession of 133 elector cardinals from across the globe moved slowly into the chapel, chanting the Litany of the Saints. The cardinals each recited an oath pledging to follow the rules of the conclave. When the doors finally closed, the cardinals went into seclusion for the first round of voting. The secretive process is expected to take multiple days and will result in new leadership for the world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics. The first smoke signal indicating whether a pope had been chosen wafted into the Italian sky Wednesday night, and it came as no surprise as it was black, indicating no decision had been reached. A quick resolution was unlikely in a gathering with no clear favorite to succeed Pope Francis, and differing views about whether the Church should follow the progressive path he set or take a more conservative direction. Despite his low profile at the time, it took less than 2 days for then-Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina to earn the two-thirds majority of votes required, as he became the first Latin American pontiff in 2013. Now the world will await however long it takes to greet the white smoke that will signal a new pope has been elected. A day before electors were sequestered to begin the conclave, an American cardinal shed light on the secretive process of electing a new pope, saying this one could take 3 or 4 days in part because there are many worthy candidates. New York Archbishop Timothy Dolan, one of 10 U.S. cardinals participating in the vote, told SiriusXM's Catholic Channel on Tuesday that participants consult with each other to learn more about contenders they might not know as well. "We're not horse trading here," Dolan said. "We're saying, tell me about this guy. You're from Latin America. Go through the list of bishops. Tell me some of these fellows. Am I right to be enchanted by this guy?" Dolan related a conversation he had with his friend Giuseppe Bettori, an Italian cardinal who served as Archbishop of Florence from 2008 to 2024. Dolan said it was helpful to learn from Bettori about Italian cardinals and bishops, and in turn he shared his thoughts about American candidates. With 108 of the 133 cardinals joining the voting ranks during Francis' 12-year tenure, and at least 25 of them coming from countries that have never voted before, those exchanges may be more valuable than ever in what's regarded as a wide-open contest. People say, "Oh, do you have a problem choosing a candidate?" Dolan said. "I'm saying, yeah, not because there's not enough of them, but because there's quite a few of them." The electors have been banned since medieval times from communicating with outsiders during conclaves. In keeping with current times, the Vatican has taken high-tech measures to ensure secrecy, including the use of jamming devices. Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re, Dean of the College of Cardinals, presided over the group's mass at the start of the day for the election of the Roman Pontiff at St. Peter's Basilica. He called for unity in faith and prayer and said the new Pope is facing a difficult, complex, and troubled turning point in history. Cardinal Robert McElroy, Archbishop of Washington, D.C., called the conclave process profound and mysterious. Instead of any possible favorites to succeed Francis, I can give you no insights into who is ahead. More than 200 of the 266 popes were natives of Italy, although it's been 47 years since an Italian served as pontiff. Francis was the first from Latin America. There have been none hailing from the U.S., numerous cardinals from Italy and other nations are considered contenders. It's been centuries since a candidate emerged with two-thirds majority required to become pope on the first ballot. The cardinals can vote only once Wednesday, then likely will need to reconvene Thursday morning. A mass will be celebrated in the Pauline Chapel before they return to the Sistine Chapel for mid-morning prayer and that day's rounds of voting. Up to four rounds of voting are permitted each day. At the conclusion of Thursday's voting, there will be an evening prayer before they return to their lodging at Casa Santa Marta. If the votes fail to result in someone receiving a two-thirds majority, they will return for more voting Friday, and as many days as required to elect a pontiff. After a cardinal receives the required number of votes and agrees to take on the monumental task, white smoke will signal his selection. Some of the cardinals frequently mentioned as candidates to succeed Francis include non-Italians Luis Antonio Tagle, 67, of the Philippines, a liberal sometimes referred to as Francis II, and Peter Erdo, 72, of Hungary, who is considered a favorite among the more conservative cardinals. Tagle has a fan in Myra Bay, who has lived in Rome for years but is originally from the Philippines. "That's why I'm here today, to support him, even though my prayers will be with whoever is elected," Baye, 25, told the Associated Press at St. Peter's Square. There have been 266 popes, and 217 of them have been Italian. Italy has strong contenders this time, including top candidate Pietro Parolin, 70, the Vatican Secretary of State, who is considered a moderate, and Matteo Zioppi, 69, a close associate of Francis. One round of voting is expected Wednesday. Then up to four rounds can take place on each subsequent day. There is no set time limit for the conclave, but recent conclaves have lasted only a few days. Since 1846, cardinals have taken 2 to 5 days to make decisions on the past 12 popes. The Reverend Patrick Flanagan, Associate Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at St. John's University in New York, says Gregory X made it clear that conclaves should be focused and expeditious. According to the original prescription, if a pope had not been elected after 3 days, a cardinal was restricted to one dish at their meals, Flanagan said. After 8 days, only bread, wine, and water. After Pope Clement IV died in November 1268, cardinals met in Viterbo, Italy, about 68 miles from Rome, to vote on a successor. The papacy was vacant for almost 3 years as disagreements dragged on. Frustrated citizens of Viterbo finally locked the cardinals in the episcopal palace and even removed the roof to expose them to the elements, hoping to expedite the decision-making process, according to ucatholic.com. The eventual winner, Gregory X, tightened up conclave rules. The longest conclave in modern times, in 1903, ended when Pope Pius X was chosen after 5 days. The first thing the new pope will do is choose a name. In the history of the papacy, the most commonly used name has been John, first chosen in 523 by St. John I, the Vatican said. The last pope to choose that name was Italian Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli, elected Pope John XXIII in 1958. Roncalli was proclaimed a saint by Pope Francis in 2014. Other frequently used names include Gregory, in honor of Pope Gregory I, commonly known as Saint Gregory the Great, 590-604. The last to use that name was Gregory the 16th in 1831. Benedict has been chosen 16 times, including by Francis' predecessor, Joseph Ratzinger of Germany, in 2005. Other popular pope names include Clement, Innocent, Leo, and Pius. 7 of 11 popes from 1775 to 1958 were named Pius, from Pius VI, 1775 to 1799, and Pius XII, 1939 to 1958. The Swiss Guard, the Pope's iconic bodyguards, are protecting the Sistine Chapel as cardinals assemble to elect a new pope. They look ceremonial in their Renaissance-style uniforms that serve as homage to the epic last stand the guards once made to defend a pope. It's a declaration they are willing to do so again, according to Bry Jensen, a historian and host of a podcast about the papacy. In 1527, renegade soldiers from the Holy Roman Empire were indignant over not being paid and attacked Rome. The attack came amid burgeoning anti-church sentiment in Europe. 147 of the 189 Swiss guards, including their commander, died to give Pope Clement VII time enough to escape, Jensen, host of the Pontificat's show, told USA Today. Here are the specifics of the voting process, according to the Vatican. Each cardinal writes the name of his chosen candidate on a ballot, folds it, holds it aloft, and carries it to the altar in order of rank. The cardinal places the ballot on a plate covering a chalice and says in Italian, "I call as my witness Christ the Lord, who will be my judge, that my vote is given to the one whom I believe should be elected according to God." The cardinal then uses the plate to drop the vote into the chalice, bows to the altar, and returns to his seat. Cardinals who are unable to walk give their folded ballot to a scrutineer, who follows the same procedure without reciting the oath again. Any cardinals who are too ill to be in the chapel are given ballots and a sealed box with a slit where the folded ballots can be inserted. Once the votes are cast, the infirmarii bring the box back to the chapel, where it is opened in front of the electors. The votes are counted and added to those already in the main chalice. After all votes have been cast, one of three scrutineers shakes the chalice to mix the ballots. Another scrutineer then counts them, transferring them into an empty container. If the number of ballots doesn't match the number of voters, all ballots are burned and a new vote is held immediately. If the count is correct, the ballots are opened and read. The scrutineers sit at a table before the altar. The first reads the name written on a ballot and passes it to the second, who confirms the name and hands it to the third, who reads it aloud for everyone to hear and records the vote. Once all ballots have been read and the votes tallied, the final scrutineer pierces each ballot with a needle and threads them together with string. The end of the string are tied into a knot, and the ballots are stored for safekeeping. The count is checked and verified, and before the electors leave the Sistine Chapel, all the ballots are burned in a cast iron stove. The next article is titled, "Ex-Police Officers Found Not Guilty of Murder in Tyre Nichols' Beating Death," by Andrea Yancey Bragg and Lucas Finton, USA Today Network. An out-of-town jury in the Tyre Nichols state case returned a not-guilty verdict on all counts for three of the former Memphis police officers charged in his death. Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith, Jr. were charged with second-degree murder, aggravated assault, aggravated kidnapping, official misconduct, and official oppression. After 8.5 hours of deliberation, the mostly white jury from Hamilton County found them not guilty of all charges, including lesser offenses they could have been convicted of. Five officers pepper-sprayed, punched, and kicked Nichols, a 29-year-old father, skateboarder, and FedEx worker, during a 2023 traffic stop. Release of video of the beating sparked protests and vigils across the nation and calls for change within the Memphis Police Department. During the trial, attorneys for Bean, Haley, and Smith said Nichols resisted arrest and was dangerous to the officers. They noted drugs and stolen credit cards were found in Nichols' car and said he could have had superhuman strength due to drug use. Prosecutors said the officers beat Nichols to death, pointing to his severe injuries, and tried to cover it up afterward. Nichols was pulled over in the evening hours of January 7, 2023. Haley and another officer initially pulled him over and pulled him from his car. A struggle ensued, with pepper spray being used and a taser being fired at Nichols as he ran from officers. It is unclear if the taser made contact with him. Another set of officers eventually caught up to Nichols, who was running toward his mother's house. He was less than 100 yards away when he was tackled. When more officers got to the scene, while officers held Nichols' arms and hit him with a barrage of kicks, punches, baton strikes, and pepper spray. The assault lasted minutes and was captured on body cameras and a SkyCop camera. When Nichols goes limp, he is handcuffed and leaned against an unmarked squad car. More than 20 minutes pass before he is put on a stretcher and taken to the hospital. All three former officers were convicted in federal court and faced time in federal prison. Sentencing for the federal case was postponed until the state case reached an end. Bean and Smith were acquitted of civil rights violations but found guilty of witness tampering and face up to 20 years in federal prison. Haley was found guilty on all counts, using excessive force, being deliberately indifferent to Nichols' medical needs, witness tampering, and conspiracy to witness tamper. But that jury found that when Haley violated Nichols' civil rights, it resulted in injury, not death. Haley could serve a life sentence in federal prison. There is no parole in the federal system. Two other former officers, Emmett Martin III and Desmond Mills Jr., took a plea deal and pleaded guilty in the federal case to using excessive force and conspiracy to witness tamper. Mills' plea agreement extended to the state case, and he will serve both his federal and state sentences at the same time. Martin and Mills testified during the federal trial. Mills testified during the state trial. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.